We'll call our first case, which is case number 61348, Michael Byers versus the State of Nevada. We have Mr. Evanson for the appellant, Mr. Shawcroft for the respondent. You'll note Justice Perger is not here, but he will participate in the decision of this case. He unfortunately had to be in Las Vegas today, but he will participate. So, Mr. Evanson, how much would you time would you like for rebuttal?
3 minutes, Your Honor. Thank you.
Thank you very much. You may proceed.
Thank you. May it please the Court. On behalf of Mr. Byers, we appreciate the opportunity to argue this case before you today. While all of the legal issues presented in this case are significant, I believe that for oral argument purposes, we first must address the standard of review with regard to the implied consent and the forced warrantless evidentiary blood draw that are currently statutorily authorized under NRS 484C.160 sub 7. While both the state and Mr. Byers agree in their pleadings that the ruling in this case is not final and the court must address the issue, the state urges you to apply a plain error standard because none of the issues relating to this was addressed below. They came up in McNeely. And because of that, Mr. Byers did not preserve the issues despite making motions and arguing against the admission of the evidentiary blood test in this case, albeit for different reasons. As stated in the reply brief, Mr. Byers urges this court to adopt a de novo review that is much better suited and more just than the plain error standard advocated by the state. This result is supported by multiple Nevada cases, including Enos and Colwell, which were fully briefed in the reply brief. After this standard of review is accepted by this court of de novo, McNeely and NRS 484C.160 sub 7 obviously must need to be addressed. The facts of this case on this issue are clear. For a simple allegation of driving under the influence, the trooper directed, without a warrant, Mr. Byers to submit to a forced, warrantless evidentiary blood draw. When Mr. Byers refused, he was forcibly held down by multiple law enforcement officers and his blood withdrawn by the use of a baton on a misdemeanor on a first offense. How does our state currently find itself in the unseemly business of forced, warrantless blood draws for misdemeanors? Very simply, at the root, the legislature of this state some 20 years ago made a decision. That decision was that a conviction for driving under the influence was more important than some other remedy found in other states: license revocation, registration penalties, criminal penalties of an additional nature for not consenting. That choice was made: conviction over other penalty. Concerned and caring legislators were led down a road of believing that the Constitution of this state and the Constitution of the United States would support such actions for first offense misdemeanors, for second offense misdemeanors, and for people who happen to have controlled substances in their bloodstreams, felony charges. The charging scene here is not uncommon in this state. Somebody is arrested for a DUI misdemeanor involving drugs, and they are prosecuted for being under the influence of a controlled substance, a felony, both operating from the same search required by NRS 484C.160 sub 7. The decades-old decision of the Nevada legislature and the governor has now been overruled by the United States Supreme Court in McNeely. And there is one factual distinction that I think is important to note before you today. Nowhere in any of the published McNeely opinions can I find where he was held down by law enforcement. I am told he was told he had to submit. I am told all of those things. But I have not seen in any of the McNeely opinions where he was, as Mr. Byers was in this case, held down and a baton used to straighten out his arm so that a phlebotomist could remove a blood sample. It is the position of Mr. Byers that any argument in that McNeely allows NRS 484C.160 sub 7 to exist is simply not supported by that case. No statute can make valid what McNeely says is invalid. Indeed, this court had previously ruled in State versus Jones in 1995 that a warrant must be obtained for a blood draw under NRS 484.511, which, of course, Mr. Byers was prosecuted for in this case. That irony should not be lost on this court, and it shouldn't be lost on the state. In spite of McNeely and in spite of Jones, the state continues to argue that warrantless forced blood draws are allowed because of implied consent statutes. No citation to authority is made to support that. No opposition is placed before this court telling this court that Nevada is apparently one of two states that allows warrantless forced blood draws, and we have the broadest of those two, where it can be for a misdemeanor or a first offense. At the end of the day, this argument requires not that implied consent in Nevada be overruled, but that NRS 484C.160 sub 7 be ruled unconstitutional. At some later date, the Nevada legislature and executive branch will have to find some other hammer by which to enforce implied consent. McNeely makes it clear that forced warrantless blood draws are no longer allowed, period. Should this court feel that McNeely does allow Nevada's statutory scheme, the state cannot argue that there was compliance with NRS 44C.160, as Mr. Byers was not given the breath test that is required in that statute, and there was no offer of a urine test to Mr. Byers in that test, which also appears to be required by the statute. The record is clear. The officer wanted a blood test because the officer felt it was more accurate. That is not a standard seen in any case law involving a blood draw that I have seen the accuracy of the test. It's not mentioned. But it was in this case. Without statutory compliance, the blood draw from Mr. Byers is invalid. The second issue that is very important to this case and to this state, I believe, is the unlawful user of a firearm, the unlawful user in possession of a firearm that came up in this case. Obviously, you have the forced warrantless blood draw on that issue. But more importantly, the state argues that the conviction should be merged with count five and that the conviction is moot. We don't believe it's moot. It's obvious it could be repeated. Clearly, and there is no interpretation of this statute, 202.360 sub 1 sub c, before this court, and the court should provide needed guidance to the public, attorneys, and the court system. The federal statutes on this issue are identical to Nevada's, and not one federal court, so far as is known to me, has ever agreed with the state's interpretation of this statute. None is cited by the state. This court should adopt the language and rulings of the federal courts, including the Ninth Circuit, and interpret this statute to be that you have to be more than a one-time user, as was advocated in this case. Only reason that was not found to be the law in this state by the trial court judge was because this court had not interpreted that statute. Not one court has interpreted the way that the state is advocating, or as Judge Estes ruled, it should be interpreted. The third issue that's important for Mr. Byers is the corpus delicti level of proof with regard to the ex-felon in possession of a firearm. The facts of this portion of the case are clear. Mr. Byers was asked at a justice court proceeding without counsel and without Miranda warnings questions regarding his identity. Those statements were later used to tie Mr. Byers to a felony conviction under the same name given in Lincoln County, Nevada and Las Vegas, Nevada. No fingerprints, no photos, no identification features, no marks, no tattoos, a birth date, and a common name. And by the way, the birth date does not appear on the judgments of convictions. And I would assume that the last name of Jones is fairly common and Marcus isn't that uncommon. The first thing the jury heard in this bifurcated trial on that charge of ex-felon in possession of a firearm was the admission of Mr. Byers in justice court that he was Marcus Jones. Not Marcus Jones on those convictions, or maybe it was on those convictions in the justice court, but that he was Marcus Jones. The law is clear on this. His admission cannot be admitted at a trial until the corpus delicti of the crime is proven. Well, how do you prove that somebody is an ex-felon when you're using a different name? Photos, fingerprint cards, those kinds of things. The law and the trial judge was clear on this issue. This was poorly done by the state. I don't know how often it is that this court sees a record from a trial court where a prosecutor is admonished for a level of proof being presented poorly done. No explanation is offered as to why there was no photos, No booking sheets, no fingerprint cards, no analysis made on that issue. No excuses offered. It was incredibly easy to have done this the right way, and the state simply chose not to. A felony conviction on that type of prosecution should not be allowed to stand by this court. We move to the issue of a conviction for battery on an officer. Two counts in this case for which Mr. Byers was sentenced and is currently serving time for. There are three issues present. First, was Mr. Byers in custody for the purposes of this statute when he is at a hospital being forced to take a warrantless blood draw? Second, did Mr. Byers demonstrate or otherwise show the mens rea to commit a battery on the officers? And third, was his thrashing and flailing against an unconstitutional warrantless forced blood draw even a crime under the statutes and case law that we see? As stated, there is ample case law in Nevada for this court to rule that a person is not in custody of the police when they are engaged in the forced activity of taking an evidentiary test. Simply put, you have people who are CPC who are not in custody. We have other people who are not in custody, even though law enforcement places them in handcuffs and moves them. The question that needs to be reached is, if they're undergoing a forced test or a blood draw or that kind of thing, are they in custody? We would answer that they are not. There is no mens rea shown that Mr. Byers was trying to strike the officers. He was trying to keep the blood test from happening, a warrantless, forced, unconstitutional blood test. No mens rea shown. No comments made by him. No, in fact, his head was down, pinned to the table while he's flailing about. But they're trying to say he had the intent to strike the officers that was necessary for the battery. Mr. Byers was justified by using reasonable force to avoid the forced evidentiary blood draw. There is significant case law briefed regarding those issues and significant law from this state on that issue that you can't avoid those kinds of things. He was trying to avoid being stuck by a needle, not trying to commit a battery, and that distinction needs to be made. Lastly, I would note there are double jeopardy issues here with regard to 484C.120, a misdemeanor DUI, and 453.411, the under the influence statute. As I am clear in the briefs, I hope, Mr. Byers was convicted at the preliminary hearing, which was done at the same time as the misdemeanor trial on the misdemeanor DUI. He was then tried in a felony court for being under the influence of a controlled substance. And under the influence of a controlled substance in possession of a firearm. In any event, the analysis for a double jeopardy situation when you have two separate proceedings is completely different than what the state was arguing with regards to the same proceeding. We absolutely feel that this court must hold that is an unconstitutional process that was used in this case. I've reached my time for rebuttal. Thank you.
Thank you. Okay. Counsel.
It pleases the court. Good morning. My name is Ben Shawcroft, and I'm a deputy district attorney for Churchill County, the respondent. In this matter, I'd like to initially address the good faith exception. And this is not a concession in any way of thinking that McNeely should cause this court to overturn or find our implied consent to be unconstitutional. Rather, this is a very important matter which I want to address at the outset because the good faith exception, of course, is an exception to the exclusionary rule. Ever since McNeely came out, there have been states and courts which have applied the good faith exception for those cases where the arrest, where the blood draw, or whatever it may be, occurred before the McNeely decision came out. And, of course, there's very good reason for that, most of which comes from the reason that we have the good faith exception to the exclusionary rule. And that is the purpose of the exclusionary rule. We want officers to understand what can happen if they violate the Fourth Amendment, to deter violations of the Fourth Amendment. And those courts that have looked at this have found that there is no rationale to exclude this type of evidence in those cases that happened before McNeely came down. Therefore, there's no reason to overturn convictions. There's no reason to suppress that evidence because, again, the rationale is not there to suppress that evidence. We would ask this court to follow the United States Supreme Court in Illinois v. Kroll, which is a case where an officer was relying upon a statute which was later found to be unconstitutional, which if this court follows suit, then that is the exact situation we would have here, where an officer on the street is acting on reliance upon the implied consent statute, which authorizes him to take a blood draw to obtain evidence, even by using reasonable force. And that is exactly what he did. He complied with the statute when he did that. And therefore, the only there's no reason for him to be questioning the judgment of the legislature in making that kind of decision out on the street when things are happening. The court in Kroll said, unless a statute is clearly unconstitutional, an officer cannot be expected to question the judgment of the legislature that passed the law. This is similar to the case in Davis v. U.S., where an officer was relying on binding precedent. This court has never proclaimed definitively on the constitutionality of our implied consent statute. It has on other related grounds, but not exactly on the issue that we're discussing today. I think it's also noteworthy that any cases that this court has decided on, some of those cases have relied on Schmerber, of course, which is the issue in McNeely and how courts are interpreting Schmerber. And this court has talked about Schmerber in the same way that the Ninth Circuit has talked about Schmerber, focusing not only on the totality of the circumstances, not on the exigency, but on the evanescent nature of that alcohol. So again, when we are asking our officers to comply with the Fourth Amendment, to do everything they can to comply with that, to not violate those rights, that's what they're relying upon. Statutes they presume to be constitutional, opinions from their binding courts, and again, there's nothing that these officers would have known to cause them to call into question the constitutionality of our implied consent statute. Therefore, since he was complying with that statute, there is no reason for this court to overturn the convictions, and why this court should not apply the good faith exception.
If we went that way, how would you handle his argument that he was not in lawful custody when the alleged or the battery occurred on the police officers? You're suggesting we don't need to do more than just say, well, it's a good faith exception.
No, because actually the facts are quite different than that, because he was under arrest at the time of the blood draw. And as this court has stated, and this is under Dumaine v. State, that when one is held in custody under process of law or under lawful arrest, then you are in custody for purposes of that statute. Therefore, the law is very clear on this, and there was no error by the jury in finding that he was in custody when he committed those batteries. And so, again, there was no error in the procedures taken by that officer. Going therefore to
before you shift gears, counsel.
Yes.
A number of states have refused to follow Kroll. What's your view about the positions taken in Idaho and some other states that have interpreted the exclusionary rule differently as it applies under the state's constitution?
My response to that is that is not the case here. The challenge is not under the state constitution, and I think there is actually Illinois specifically, theirs is quite different than and therefore that application has not been made in their state when applying their constitution. And they found that because of the way their constitution says, that Kroll would not apply in that regard. But Nevada has not come down that way. The only times that that we could find where this court has decided not to apply the good faith exception is when an officer is actually violating the statute as it's written. So by not complying with the statute, of course, he doesn't get the benefit of the good faith exception. But when he is in full compliance of the statute, relying upon the sound judgment of the legislature in passing that, he should not be penalized following the statute, which is what he was doing. I think it's also an interesting point that ever since McNeely came down, law enforcement agencies all across Nevada are trying to change gears a little bit. They're trying to comply with McNeely until this court makes a decision as to how it may affect our implied consent statute, which tells you the officers on the street are doing their very best to comply with the law and not violate the Fourth Amendment. And I think that's very telling here. Therefore, going specifically to the application of McNeely, we do not think that McNeely does anything that the appellant is claiming here. It does not cause this court to find our implied consent statute unconstitutional. There's a very drastic difference that we want to point out here between from McNeely to our case. And that is, in McNeely, the officer was not relying upon an implied consent statute. Initially he was, but as soon as he forced that blood draw, he was acting outside of the scope of their statute, because their statute did not authorize that. That's why the McNeely court was only able to look at another exception to the requirement of getting a warrant. They had to look for, was there exigency? That was the only way they could get around the warrant requirement. And, of course, they found that just the evanescent nature of alcohol did not constitute exigency in and of itself. So that was the very narrow holding of their case. They did not determine whether or not Missouri's implied consent statute was constitutional, again, because the officer was acting outside the scope of that statute. In our case, the officer was acting in compliance with the statute. He was not doing anything outside of the scope of that statute. And therefore, to say that McNeely should cause this court to find our implied consent statute unconstitutional extends that opinion far beyond what it really says. I think it's also telling that there is a case that had the McNeely court been really concerned about implied consent statutes across the board, they would have had to have addressed their position in a case called South Dakota versus Neville, where the court said, again, relying on the Schmerber opinion, Schmerber clearly allows a state to force a person suspected of driving while intoxicated to submit to a blood alcohol test. But they didn't address that. Therefore, it's our position that statement is still good law. Why didn't they address it? Again, they were not dealing specifically with implied consent statutes. Implied consent statutes are a useful tool that states have in order to combat drunk driving. And that was recognized by the plurality opinion, that these are legal tools that states can use to obtain this type of evidence. It's also noteworthy, I think, that in those statutes listed by that plurality opinion, many of those statutes authorize forced blood draws under certain circumstances, especially circumstances where there is substantial injury. So they're talking about these implied consent statutes as legal tools that states can use, and yet some of those statutes they've listed allow forced blood draws when someone is injured. So should there really be a difference here? Should there be a different level of constitutional
protection? Counsel, you ask if there should be a difference, but you're talking about in cases where you have injury. There was no injury here, if I understand correct. And a number of those other states that you're giving credence to allow for other types of alternatives, such as automatic taking away of the license status, criminal penalties for refusal to comply. Why is this different? And why was there such an emergency to have the blood drawn that a warrant was not obtained?
Well, the only reason I brought that up is to make the point that McNeely is not addressing implied consent statutes. And there's nothing in there that should cause us to really be concerned about what they're saying about implied consent, because they did not address that. And that's really the only purpose that I bring that up, because
but
they did not.
But there are issues, since you brought it up, as to the validity of implied consent. You've stuck that out there, and so now we need to walk down it a little bit.
Sure.
And is there validity in it, in our statute as it stands, in light of the new jurisprudence?
Okay, so looking specifically at our statute. Our statute, of course, says anybody who's going to drive on our roadways impliedly consent to one of these evidentiary tests. They are not allowed to revoke or withdraw their consent, because if they fail to comply, then they become subject to a possible forced blood draw removal.
Wasn't there some language that implied consent is too coercive as a violation of the Fourth Amendment?
In our statute? I understand that argument, but all of those courts that have looked at the coerciveness of implied consent statutes generally have found that they are not overly coercive, that they are still within the parameters of a knowingly waiver of that right to be free from search and seizures. But looking at the issue of our statute and the inability of someone to withdraw their consent, I think that's an important issue that needs to be addressed.
But doesn't McNeely require us to review this in light of the Fourth Amendment, to look at it with new eyes, not to just accept what was done before?
And I don't doubt that one bit. I think we are certainly called upon to look at that issue. But if you think about our statute and what's the legal justification for having consent that is irrevocable, and I think it goes down
fundamental issue is, can you validly consent to waive your Fourth Amendment right?
Oh, and that's a very clear exception to the warrant requirement. Consent is always an exception to a warrant requirement.
But can you be mandated, as in this situation?
There are other lines of cases which say that yes, there are situations where you are impliedly consenting to a search and you cannot revoke that, and that goes to what are commonly referred to as airport search cases. And the Ninth Circuit Court has looked at that specific issue, and they found that as soon as a passenger walks into an airport, subjects themselves to the initial screening process, security screening, that at that very point they are impliedly consenting to a secondary search, even though the security has no grounds whatsoever to do the secondary search, no suspicion whatsoever. But the court found, after you submit to that first one, you cannot revoke your consent to a secondary search. You cannot say, I just don't want to fly in an airplane today.
Do you have any cases that are post-McNeely that deal with an implied consent statute, unlike the ones that the majority of the plurality cites? They emphasize that those statutes make they can draw an adverse inference from you failing to consent to a blood draw. You can suspend their license. Those are the price tags on the implied consent statutes that they choose to emphasize in their opinion. Ours is different because it's saying the implied consent is to have us take your blood. Are there any post-McNeely cases that you know of that say that is valid, notwithstanding McNeely, because it's applying a consent exception rather than an exigency exception?
Unfortunately, there are few opinions out there right now applying McNeely, and the ones that we've looked at have not specifically addressed that issue. They have found other reasons to either get away from McNeely, other opinions that have been sent out but then withdrawn by the court, and so no, we're not able to.
So the answer is no.
The answer is no. We're not be able to cite.
But that's what you'd like us to hold, right?
Of course.
Okay.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Your time's up. Mm-hmm. Mr. Evanson, you just have about 2.5 minutes left.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Your Honor. I would first like to address Justice Hardesty's question. I think Nevada has a well-stated and long history of interpreting the Nevada Constitution to be broader than what is offered under the federal Constitution. This court has done it on numerous occasions in numerous cases, and I think this court is free to do that in this case, should it so choose. Additionally, I would note that the implied consent statute question that Justice Pickering asked, of course that hasn't been reached anywhere else because we're the only ones that allow it for a misdemeanor case. So it's up to you to say whether or not that's it. And it does transcend other parts of the implied consent statute. As you may recall, if you take a test on a breath machine and it's out of compliance 0.02, they can have you take a third. And the third test, if it's out of compliance 0.02 with the prior two, the next test shall be blood. And if you refuse that under our statutes on a misdemeanor, first offense, they'll hold you down. That choice that was made by the legislature 20 years ago, Mr. Shawcross said it best, it's never been looked at by this court. It's never been analyzed for its constitutionality before. Yet he is arguing that there's a good faith exception for my client who sits in Nevada State Prison because of it. It's okay in his case, but it won't be good in any others. That is the height of what Enos and Colwell said was an unfair result when there's this much of a sea change in the law. And we would just ask that you apportion the law accordingly. We believe our other arguments that we raised with regard to the improper closing arguments and the dangerousness and the other issues and the double jeopardy stand true. I have about a minute left. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Maybe just on the battery issue, your opposing counsel said that your client was under arrest when he was taken to for the blood draw. If he were under arrest, then wouldn't the battery charges be valid there upon the officers?
The terminology of arrest, I think, is often used in civil protective custody cases. In the case recently last year involving the juvenile and those issues, I think the fact analysis needs to be: is this person trying to commit a battery, or are they trying to resist something that's unconstitutional? That's part of it. The moment the cuffs go on and the officer says you're under arrest, I will grant that the case law in Nevada generally says, with the exception of the two cases I cited, CPCs and the juveniles, that you're under arrest.
Hey, thank you very much. Thank you both for your excellent arguments and briefs. We will take this case.